Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, in this week's episode, we continue our conversation with Dr. Roy Baumeister. He's the author of the book, Is There Anything Good About Men? Enjoy.
And you mentioned just a moment ago about the importance for reward for men, it seems. Men will do these crazy, risky things to gain respect or admiration or recognition from larger society. But it seems like our society, some people would say, that we don't value or we want to diminish risk, and we shouldn't glorify things like violence or going off and sailing across the world or whatever these things that people do nowadays. I mean, if you take away that reward for risk, I mean, are men going to be, I mean, is that kind of kills the motivation for men?
I don't think it's that society is glorifying risk per se. It's just that some jobs require risk. When there's a burning building, somebody has to go into it and try to save the people into it. Somebody has to stand up and try to put out the fire. And all these risks are dangerous. When there are criminals, you have to engage in a shootout with them. Well, there's some risk there, but somebody has to do it. When it's a matter of driving trucks all night or climbing up into high and dangerous places to fix things that are damaged, well, somebody has to do these things. And they contain some risk. It's not going to be possible to eliminate fatal risk from our society. And so, in general, society sees that those jobs should be done by men. To some extent, we open them up for women, but women aren't as interested in those jobs either, even though they might pay a little more. Women work indoors much more than men. Women work other sorts of jobs that are safer and contain less physical risk. It's a choice, it's a trade-off that people make, but I didn't mean to suggest that society is encouraging people to do crazy things as stunts. Occasionally that happens, but there are simply some jobs that inevitably come with some degree of danger with them.
Well, I remember one part, and I think this is what I was trying to get to, and I think I just misspoke, where you talked about the motivation for boys in schools. We started seeing this decline when the whole self-esteem movement started picking up, and everyone was given high grades. Everyone's, you know, they're encouraging. They give rewards to anybody, no matter even if everyone didn't do very well. And I think you might have suggested somewhere in your book that, you know, if for boys or for men, that if no one can fail, then there's no risk involved, or, you know, everyone's treated the same, then there's really no point, because, you know, you can't earn that glory, I guess, is, I think, what you mentioned.
Yeah, I think there is a difference. I think the self-esteem movement is something that's probably better for girls than for boys. A little more encouragement and reassurance maybe goes down well with the girls. And grade inflation and things like that, everybody getting an A. Well, if you get an A with everybody else getting an A, in a sense, perhaps that's more okay with the girl than the boy. There's still some striving for greatness, some desire more to be the one. And this goes back to the biological differences. Again, you know, we're descended from twice as many women as men, are the ancestors of today's human race, twice as many women as men there, which meant that in order to pass along your genes, we're descended from the people who successfully passed on their genes. The man, much more than the woman, had to stand out, had to fight his way to the top, had to dominate some hierarchy. So competing against other men to be one of the few elite and winners, that's more deeply rooted in the male than in the female psyche. Our schools, we know the boys are not doing as well as girls these days. There's much worrying about what that means and what the prognosis is. We have changed, certainly, our schools in many ways with the best of intentions. I think there was a time we felt that the schools were failing girls and they needed to do more to take care of girls. But there are very strong, outspoken voices all over looking out for the interests of girls. There's pretty much nobody looking out for the interests of boys. And so when a school has a decision to make, we decided some time ago that we're going to treat boys and girls the same, and then we have to decide, well, should we do what's best for the girls or what's best for the boys? Well, to do what's best for the boys would be seen as sexist and would provoke an outcry to do what's best for the girls seems more appropriate and fine. And so over and over again, the schools and administrators, who again are mostly women, make that decision, and everyone goes along with it. And the upshot is we've gotten to where we are essentially raising boys like girls, which is probably not the best thing for bringing out the best in the boys. Here, you know, issues are speculation. Here I go beyond what's the solid factual knowledge, and I have to do a little bit of guesswork. But with things like the self-esteem movement being better for girls, well, we know girls have very slightly lower self-esteem than boys, and especially, say, in the teen years, the boys tend to be more egotistical and narcissistic. Probably nature's way of preparing the young male for the rather challenging competition that it's had to take in competing and trying to get to be the top, you know, back in our biological heritage, which the girl did not so much have to do. And so confidence to fight and compete was probably more necessary. It's what we don't like about the male ego, but it probably had a valid biological function. But now to bolster them that and tell young men and reassure their self-esteem, that sort of ends up cultivating this narcissism that much more, which I think is a destructive trait and not conducive. The cultures that have done best at producing successful crops of men have tended to instill humility instead in the young men to try to puncture their egotistical balloon and bring them down to earth and say, you got to learn your place and earn your position and achieve and accomplish and fight your way to the top and prove yourself, rather than have respect just given to you for being there. And so when we instead just give them respect and everything, then I think that doesn't do what's best for the young male psyche.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. And now back to the show.
So you talk about marriage and sex in your book, and one of the issues you discuss is why so many younger men today are putting off marriage longer and longer. Are men trying to stay in eternal adolescence, or is there something else going on here?
I think there are several things going on. The eternal adolescence argument is perhaps a reproach or a ploy or a way to manipulate men, even though there may be something to it. For one thing, if you take the long view, I should add, age of first marriage has gone up and down throughout history. We tend to compare to the 1950s when it was exceptionally low. It was higher, I think, in the early parts of the 20th century, and it has gone up and down with various factors. It is going up now, and perhaps higher than it's ever been. So we want to look. Probably there are a couple things going on. For one thing, the one of the main reasons that pressured people into marrying early was that was the only way to have sex. Yet that's no longer a constraint, that single people can have plenty of sex. And so one of the main reasons to rush and get married early has been taken away. And the eternal adolescence, well, there may be, as I said, as we put less pressure on young people to mature and grow up and take on adult roles, you know, we allow them to stay in dependent roles of being a student, things like that. Well, then, why not stay in adolescence a little bit longer? Adolescence can be a very pleasant time, especially when all your needs are taken care of and you have money and a nice place to live and people to sleep with and people to have fun with. And so rushing into a more structured marriage kind of thing is maybe not as appealing as it might have been another time. I should add, too, though, that the idea that men are resisting this, well, you can look at that. I mean, that's how the women might see it, but you can look at it the other way. Why are the women pushing men to be married? I think there's a basic rationality in both the women wanting to get married earlier and the men wanting to put it off. For one thing, assuming you want to get married, you want to get the best possible partner. That depends on your appeal as a mate. And to simplify things rather drastically, the biggest factor in a woman's appeal is her physical looks and beauty and attractiveness. The biggest thing in a man's appeal is his ability to make money and be a provider. Well, those have different time courses. The woman's looks tend to peak earlier than the man's earning power, so that as you go from 20 to 30 to 40, well, very few women look as look as good at 40 as they did at 20, and so their ability to attract the most desirable partner has probably gone down steadily over that period of time, whereas a man's ability in terms of his earning power probably goes up from 20 to 30 to 40. So his mate appeal, his desire to attract women, has gone up over that time. Hence, year by year, each year the woman thinks, I should try to get married because next year my prospects will be a little worse than they are this year, whereas each year the man can think, my prospects will be a little better next year than this year, so there is no hurry. And that's just how they do it, and there are a few other complicating factors that men and women tend to marry, with the man being a couple years older than the woman. And yet, as people get older, there are fewer, there's more and more a surplus of women. So again, though, that brings the same pressure that the woman wants to marry earlier when there are a lot more older men available. If the man waits longer, there are more and more younger women available. So it's in the man's interest to wait, whereas it's in the woman's interest not to wait. Then we also have the childbearing factor, that one of the reasons people get married is to have children, although people have children without being married, but it's still seen as a better way to do it. And there, too, the woman's time for having children is limited, so she is better off marrying earlier and having her children earlier, but there's certainly no rush in the male. That a woman who's 40 usually is done having children. If she's going to reproduce after that, she might have one or two, and just to be extra careful and so on. A man at 40 still can have a dozen children in his life, or more if he's particularly enterprising. So there's no rush for him to get that over and done with in the same way. And then, there are even broader questions about who gets what out of marriage. What are the benefits? What is the value? Well, one way to look at marriage is it society's way of transferring money from men to women. Certainly that tends to be what happens in divorce, a lot of the money is taken from the man and transferred to the woman. I can see men saying there, well, what do I get out of it? Now both men and women are happier, a little happier when they are married than when they are not, so there's an increase there. Marriage does have intangible benefits, but if you just wanted to take a cold calculating approach to it, it makes perfect sense for men to postpone marriage and even question whether they should do it at all.
So what's been the response to your book? You lay out some pretty controversial things that I'm sure some women in academia wouldn't go over well with them. But overall, what has been your response?
Well, the book just came out, so I haven't heard that much response. I did make sure to circulate the book to women as well as men in academia before I released it, because I wanted to have something that people felt would be fair to both sides and would be respectful of everybody, because this is in no way this is not a pro-man book or an anti-woman book or anything like that. It is trying to argue that basically men and women are different in some ways, more in what they want than in what they're capable of, that men and women have mostly worked together, they've not been enemies, that they're partner, and that maybe they should appreciate each other a little more. That's my message, and I think it's a very positive and friendly message. So that's what I'm hoping people will get from it. Now, there's an entrenched dogma about gender differences built up with this mostly victim mentality by some feminist scholars. And I used to call myself a feminist. My wife jokes that I'm more of a feminist than she ever was. But I'm a little older. Feminism in the 70s was open to everybody and meant openness to new ideas, meant challenging orthodox views and dogmas, trying to make everyone have opportunities and equality, and I still support those ideals. But feminism has moved away from that, as many scholars have argued, and has now become much more dogmatic and defending a particular view and promoting women at the expense of men. And I can't go with it on that. And so those people are certainly not going to like a book that says, men and women are equal and get along. I think, if anything, one of the most issues that feminism is really built on, this seeing men and women as basically enemies, that men and women are fundamentally at odds with each other and that there's a struggle or battle of the sexes. And I said, well, I want to get past the battle of the sexes, that men and women have been on the same side, cooperating more than other and complementing each other and helping each other. The history is mostly, is not been about men against women. History has mostly been about groups of men supported by their women competing against other groups of men. And if you want to look at warfare or trade or science or exploration or whatever, it was generally competitions among groups of men, all of whom were crucially aided and supported by their women. So I'm trying to have a kinder, gentler, more harmonious view of gender relations, and not everyone's going to like that.
Well, I thought the book was fascinating. It was a really interesting read. You know, it does bring up, does challenge a lot of things you hear in the popular culture, and even when you're at school and undergrad. And I think a lot of men would enjoy reading it and just find it very fascinating. Well, Professor Baumeister, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us, and I wish you all the luck with your book.
Thank you very much, Brett. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness blog at artofmanliness.com. And until next time, stay manly.